Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Being online can provide children with wonderful opportunities to learn and to socialize. But children being online also comes with risk. Online sexual exploitation and abuse is a terrible reality that too many children have to live through. And as the threats that children face evolve, particularly in the digital age, so our responses need to evolve along in tandem with this evolution. So to better respond to this need, the Disrupting Harm Research Project was designed to better understand how digital technology facilitates sexual abuse and exploitation of children and adolescents. And this research project was conducted in 14 different countries, Malaysia being one of them. Saskia Bloom joins me on the show today to discuss the Malaysian chapter of the report. She is the Chief of Child Protection for UNICEF Malaysia. Saskia, thank you for joining me on the show. I mentioned the Disrupting Harm project a little bit earlier, but I'm curious to understand more about how UNICEF and its partners view the necessity of the report and what were the intended outcomes of it.
Sure. Thank you so much, Melissa, for having me on the show and giving, you know, a bit of space to discuss this really important issue. You situated it so well. The report was launched because there was a recognition that this is an issue that affects children globally, including in Malaysia. So it's the first report of its kind that looks at a number of countries at the issue of online sexual exploitation and abuse. And we implemented this research together with Interpol and with ECPAT. So they were our main implementing partners. But also, you know, we really work closely with different government counterparts. So just to mention the Malaysian Communication Multimedia Commission, Ministry of Women and Ministry of Health, amongst many others. But you were asking, you know, what were we hoping for? Mm-hmm. We recognize that this is a new risk for children. We all see children around us online all the time. So this was not a research for research sakes. This was really to understand what we need to change to disrupt the harm. So this, hence the title, Disrupting Harm. So for, on the one hand, for a government to have the evidence base to inform policies and responses and to bring attention to the issue, because too many children, parents, caregivers, teachers, everyone in interacting with children are not necessarily aware of the risk and what to do to protect children better.
Yes, definitely. I agree with you about the need to better educate about this issue. I remember speaking to UNICEF, you know, even before the pandemic, this was always an area of concern for UNICEF. And now there is this multi-country research findings that we have. For Malaysia in particular, Saskia, what did the study find that you think is important to note?
Mm-hmm. I think maybe first of all, to have a quick trigger warning for those that may have been victims of exploitation abuse of any kind. So you may want to tune out, do take care of yourselves. In terms of the main findings, maybe to just highlight two. So first of all, the number, right? So we found that 4% of all internet using children between the ages of 12 and 17 have been victim of some type of online sexual exploitation and abuse. So what could that mean? That could mean blackmail to engage in sexual activities. That could mean someone else sharing their sexual image without their consent. Or it could mean being coerced to engage in sexual activities through promises of money or gifts as well. And you may think, okay, 4%, is that really that high? But of course, when scaled to the population of the 12 to 17 year olds in this country, it's 100,000 children. Or in a classroom of 25 students, you know, there's one student that would have been victim. So in addition to that, we think that underreporting, because there's so much stigma around it, which I hope we can discuss a bit more, underreporting is very likely. And it's the past year only. So that's, you know, just to give you a number, to give you, you know, a sense of the scale and the number. And maybe apart from the number, just let me highlight very briefly one other finding, which is what we found is that online and offline becomes very blurred. What might start as online grooming becomes, you know, comes into real life. So, or what might start, you know, in person might, you know, go online later on. So the lines between the two worlds, they're very much blurred. And, you know, it's one world for children, really, the online and the offline world.
Okay, but if we were to focus on the online world, Saskia, what do we understand about the platforms on which this this online sexual exploitation and abuse happens?
Yeah, so children mainly experience it on the major social media platforms that we all know. You know, WhatsApp, Facebook, Facebook Messenger, WeChat, Telegram. There were some of the most prominent ones that were named in the research. And of course, more needs to be done by those platforms. One of the recommendations in the report is not only to have reporting mechanisms built into the platforms, but also to really outline in child-friendly terms what happens after you report. So to encourage more children to report what has happened to them.
Right. And this brings me to my next question about underreporting, which you raised a little bit earlier. We see this with, you know, cases of sexual violence, sexual abuse. For adults, but when it comes to children, Saskia, what barriers have you discovered that exist that, you know, prevent children from telling the adults in their lives about these types of incidences?
Yeah, so this is, as a parent myself, I really took this finding to heart because we found that half of the children that experienced online sexual abuse and exploitation did not tell anyone before they were asked this question in the survey. And some of the reasons, of course, we asked about the reasons, what held them back. They felt shame, stigma. We felt stigma, especially for boy victims in particular. And they did not know where to report. And some also reported that they did not believe that if they would report what has happened to them, that action would be taken. So I think this is really devastating because if children do not report, you know, we cannot help protect them. And I think first we need to overcome the shame and stigma around this topic. We need to open up the space to talk about it. So I'm really happy that, you know, you're giving us some of the space tonight, Melissa. Parents in particular and caregivers need to create the environment where they can have that dialogue and conversation with their children so that they feel open and confident to talk to, you know, an adult in their life. And we need children and their caregivers to know where to report to and that action will be taken.
Speaking about the role of the adults, role of parents and caretakers, you know, not from a lack of concern or a lack of attention, but many parents are ill-equipped to understand the digital age. You know, many children are digital natives. Parents are born perhaps in a different generation. And the lack of this understanding of the digital world may hinder them from being the best guardians that they can be online. What do you see to be the role of parents, particularly in having this digital awareness of the exploitation and abuse that can happen?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, the disconnect. Actually, interestingly, though, in Malaysia, the number of caregivers that are online is pretty much matching the number of children that are online. In many other countries, we have a big disconnect that many more young people and children are online versus their caregivers. That obviously decreases with age. So children that might be taken care of mainly by their grandparents, they might have, you know, a counterpart that's not as online savvy. We've seen it in the research as well. But I think the most important message here for parents and caregivers is that being online is unavoidable, and the response of this report should not be to restrict online access, because, you know, children will be online, you know, in different ways in any case, and we need to rather teach them how to be safe online. Also, if we restrict access in response to, you know, what we perceive as risk, we might end up creating fear to tell and come forth in the first place. So So I think that is an important message from this report. Don't be too scared to allow your child to remain online, to be online, but really accompany your child and see how they're engaging and have open conversations if they ever come across anything that scares them. Anything they want to discuss with you, and maybe say that's also sometimes difficult for you to navigate. You know, who are you interacting with online? How do you make sure that information you find online is safe? And I think having an open dialogue and conversation is really important.
All right. Can I ask you, what are the policy recommendations? I mean, we talked a little bit about what parents and guardians and caretakers can do, but at a national level, what can policymakers do to make sure that this doesn't just become statistics and headlines, that there's actually a framework to address the underlying problem?
Yeah, absolutely, Melissa. I think that the Disrupting Harm report, first of all, showed that there are a lot of existing initiatives that are really laudable. There is a dedicated Malaysian Internet Crime Against Children unit, for example. Not every country has this. There are one-stop centers in hospitals. There are specialized children's courts for sexual crimes. And also the social workers, by the government, but also community-based organizations and so forth. But I think the common message across is that we need to invest more into these existing services. A lot of the frontline workers were very dedicated. They're understaffed, overworked. And that also we need to increase the capacity of those frontline workers who might also not have dealt with online exploitation and abuse before. With other cases, and they need to be upskilled and capacitated to know how to deal with these new risks that children face.
Did the reports reveal anything interesting in terms of who are the more vulnerable groups? I mean, who's more at risk? Was there any evidence to perhaps identify which children are more likely to be harmed online?
Yeah, so we did an analysis between, boys and girls, rural and urban, different strata of households. And, the interesting finding is that all children are at risk. So it's not, we did not find a particular risk profile. So it's really, a pledge to everyone who interacts with children to keep an eye out and to be a helping hand.
So the duty to prevent and to disrupt harm is across the board to all children. Risk is equal to every child. Thank you so much, Saskia. I appreciate your time. Saskia Bloom from UNICEF Malaysia there. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more on this topic. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. A report on online child sexual exploitation and abuse, which is based on a survey done by UNICEF and its partners, had found that in the past year alone, 100,000 internet-using children between the ages of 12 to 17 have been subjected to clear instances of online child sexual exploitation and abuse in Malaysia. And this includes, but not limited to, being blackmailed to engage in sexual activities or being coerced to do so through promises of money or gifts, and or having their sexual images shared without their permission. And, of this astronomical figure of children, half of them had no idea how to report the crime. Now, if you would like to report a crime, if you hear anything tonight, you would like to make a report, we'll make sure that the number, it will be shown on the screen. Please do take note of it. But for now, let me introduce my next guest on the show. Tulasi Munisami is the Advocacy and Partnerships Director for Protect and Save the Children. Tulasi, thank you for joining me on the show today. These numbers that were mentioned by the UNICEF report are worrying, definitely. And, I've also seen in the headlines recently the police saying that 100,000 Malaysian IP addresses involved in the manufacture, the distribution, the sharing of child sex abuse materials. I'm just wondering, in your line of work, Dilisi, what would you understand to be the current situation? Are the threats faced by our children online growing?
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me over. You're right. The threats are real. It's increasing. So the disrupting harm study, right? The findings is not new, but it shows that it's evidence-based and it's escalated and it's very well documented. So, you know, the findings are already showing and telling you about data, giving you information as to which platforms children are using, where are they experiencing online child sexual exploitation abuse, who is perpetrating them. I mean, interestingly, in the context of Malaysia, the findings show that, you know, the perpetrators are unknown to the child. I'm not sure that you read it, but it's unknown. And in my line of work, usually the perpetrators are known to the child. Usually it's the neighbor or family member or, you know, your friend or somebody who's close to you, you know. And in this case, it's really unknown to the child. And so it's really giving room for policymakers to think about what they need to do in terms of safeguarding children when they have to go online. Also, in the disrupting harm panel discussion launch event, right? I mean, the launch event, but there was a panel discussion there. There was this judge, her name is Judge Kuna, and she shared that we lack legal companions for children in the courtroom. So when you think about it, it's important that we need that legal companion because children who have experienced online sexual exploitation abuse experience trauma at a different level. And then we're exposing them to re-traumatization without a legal companion in the courtroom. And, you know, you don't have a, well, we do have child-friendly courts, but we need to amplify them. And the processes and the procedures need to be child-friendly and child-centered. And Judge Kuna also shared that some children have no clue that violence had been perpetrated on them and they lack awareness on their rights and protection. I mean, the research report also highlights the need for strengthened policy and legislation surrounding online child sexual exploitation abuse. You know, we really need better reporting mechanisms. We need child-friendly courts, legal and justice systems. We need better functioning reporting helplines and, you know, internet platforms to be able to, for children to be able to report. And we also need, like all the authorities, your parents, your families, your caregivers, the teachers, they all need to have information on digital literacy and they need to be well equipped to have conversations or open conversations with their children on comprehensive sexuality education and the risk of online, you know, and when children go online, what are those risks? And I think one thing really stood out for me was also in the context of Malaysia, you know, and I'm a product of kinship care. We've always lived with, you know, or grown up with grandparents or uncles and aunties. And so the report also highlighted that older caregivers who are caring for children, they need to be familiar with the online platforms that children are using and the risk of oxia, basically.
Yeah. I mean, you brought up so many interesting points for us to unpack on the rest of the in the rest of the show. And I completely agree with you about guardians, you know, particularly if we are from a different generation from our digital native children, it makes it difficult to be vigilant if you don't really understand the nuances of the platform, but also understand how adolescents are using the platform today, how they're communicating. All of these, I think, fall through the gaps of even the most watchful parents' eyes. Can I ask you to delve a little bit into that about because of the underreporting that we see in cases of child online child sexual exploitation and abuse, what advice would you give to the parents and the teachers and the caregivers and the grandparents and to children themselves to help break the silence around sexual violence, particularly online. And as you mentioned, particularly if the children themselves are not aware that a crime has been perpetrated against them.
Thanks, Melissa. I think it's really important that we don't practice the old style of parenting, right? Very authoritative kind of parenting. It has to be, you know, the parenting of now for the generation, because parents and caregivers need to already have open conversations and discussions about sex, sexuality, you know, gender equality, and they need to also embrace digital literacy for themselves and also educate themselves on online safety and online child sexual exploitation and abuse, and they need to know how to facilitate the conversations in a very interactive, in a very fun and loving manner. Because obviously the moment you talk to them or you talk to the children in a lecture style mode, they're not going to listen to you anymore. So it has to be done in a very facilitated way and have open conversations. And from my case management experience, I've already observed that, you know, when parents and caregivers or teachers, when they don't speak to children about sex, about sexuality, about reproductive health rights, and they are monitored minimally or they lack parental supervision, they face greater risk of being sexually abused and exploited online and also offline, which then obviously leads to, you know, either rape or molestation, your teenage pregnancies, your baby dumping, you know, illegal abortions, like all different risks, right? Mm-hmm. And you also have children who then may manifest risky social and emotional behaviors. In my line of work, I've also seen children who've been exposed to online sexual abuse materials who are then manifesting risky sexual behaviors to other children or adults. And right. So the conversations with children on sex and sexuality, reproductive health rights, it needs to be normalized. They need to feel safe, supported, and comfortable to tell the parents or the caregivers or their grandparents or their aunties, uncles about what's happening to them.
Right. Thalisi, can I ask you, I mean, Sorry to interrupt you, but I do want to know whether, so what you're pointing to places a lot of the onus on the child themselves and also to the immediate caregivers. Is there a role for policy in not just ending online child sexual exploitation and abuse, but preventing it, or as the report said, disrupting the harm before it happens?
So if you're talking about policy, we've got our national child policy, we've got the plan of action, we've got all this legislation, we've got the Sexual Offences Act, we've got your Child Act, anti-trafficking, etc. We've also got the Education Act and the Communication and Multimedia, but all of this, it needs to synergize, it needs to integrate your online child sexual exploitation abuse risk, whether it's prevention response, it needs to be integrated, it needs to be included in your guidelines, existing guidelines, your SOPs, your policies, you know, in the Sharia law, it also needs to be included there. So like, you know, for instance, one may think, oh, it's really not necessary to integrate, you know, online child sexual exploitation and abuse risk in the suspected child abuse and neglect guidelines under the one-stop crisis center. But actually, it's not true, right? Because the moment you're a victim, you're a child victim of sexual exploitation abuse, you need to go to the SCAN team at the One Stop Crisis Center. So it has to be included. We need child safeguarding policies in schools, better reporting mechanisms institutionalized that reflect this issue. We need child-friendly reporting mechanisms. We need policies on interagency coordination between the helplines, between the child protectors, between the police officers, your law enforcement, your judges, your social workers, the medical and psychosocial workforce. Because right now, the moment you report, we don't know what happens at the back end, you know. So we need a policy on interagency coordination. Also need a policy on information management system, because you need that data for better programming, for better advocacy purpose. So
Yeah, definitely. Thilisi, thank you so much for helping, you know, paint such a clear picture of the framework that goes behind, particularly, you know, when you're managing cases of online child sexual exploitation and abuse. So appreciate your time. Thilisi Munisamy there from Protect and Save the Children. That wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching and good night.